Okay, Mi, so I think that's a pretty good overview of the approach. The differential diagnosis is, it's involved, but it's not that involved. I think it's pretty manageable. Basically, there's structural and non-structural, and definitely the big elephants in the room, if you will, medically, are they suffering from a systemic disease or do they have a coagulopathy? That's really kind of the size of it. In the end, most of these patients end up on some type of hormonal therapy. Even if there are fibroids, even if there are some structural things, the dysfunctional uterine bleeding ends up being the vast majority of the diagnosis in most of these cases. So they usually end up on some sort of hormonal treatment before they leave the department.
I've always found that the terminology of anovulatory bleeding or ovulatory dysfunction and dysfunctional uterine bleeding sort of all interchange. And I find it actually, frankly, confusing. So do you have a better way of simplifying that?
Absolutely. Now, as we mentioned, the vast majority of these women are going to be treated with hormonal therapy. And that's because whether they're ovulating or they're not ovulating, Mies, the vast majority of these patients have abnormal bleeding because of an abnormal hormonal profile. That's what it really breaks down to. And
Okay. The
vast majority of the hormonal problems relate to the fact that a woman is not ovulating. That's why sometimes you'll hear the word anovulatory bleeding interchange with dysfunctional uterine bleeding. Okay.
That makes sense.
Now, there are patients that ovulate that also have problems with hemorrhage and essentially their hormonal problem as well. And they're treated with oral contraceptive hormonal pills as well. But the majority have this abnormal, irregular, at times really heavy bleeding that is anovulatory. And I want to explain why that happens because it really helps understand the treatment. And so what exactly is going on here is that when you don't ovulate, the uterus builds up and builds up and builds up, okay, with the effect of estrogen, which is the principal female hormone. And in the absence of ovulation, which signals the change from buildup to stabilization of the uterine wall in preparation for pregnancy, that's exactly what's happening here, okay, is that the ovulation happens midway through the cycle of this buildup of a uterine wall that's building up waiting for a fetus. And then when ovulation happens, the second hormone of the cycle, which is the progesterone, which maintains that lining for the duration of the pregnancy, kicks into gear.
Mm-hmm.
When a woman does not ovulate, the buildup of the uterine wall with estrogen just keeps building and building and building. There's no stabilization phase. And sometimes when I've talked about this, I've compared it to building a wall, a brick wall, without mortar, so that the bricks are building up with the estrogen and the progesterone, the stabilization hormone, the hormone of pregnancy, if you will, is the mortar that holds that wall stable.
I like that visual. Okay.
In patients that don't ovulate, just imagine a brick wall being built up and built up and built up with no mortar to hold it together. And periodically, Mizuho, you're going to have pieces of that wall falling off. Sometimes big, huge chunks of the wall will fall off and really frighten the patient. You'll get a huge burst of blood. And until that uterine lining gets stabilized with progestins and hormonal therapy, it's going to keep causing unpredictable, irregular sloughing, sometimes massive sloughing of blood. And that basically is the picture of an anovulatory bleed. And poster child of that, if you will, is the woman with polycystic ovary disease.
Yeah, I can see that.
Or Stein-Leventhal syndrome. And that basically is a disorder usually of women who are overweight. So they have lots of fat cells that are making too much estrogens and they're building up that wall, that uterine lining. Because of this imbalance of hormones that they have, they're unable to stabilize that lining of the uterus. They don't ovulate and they come in with this terrible complaint of irregular, sometimes frightening.
So, Stuart, I think I just had an aha moment as you're describing the wall, and I love that visual. So, anovulatory dysfunction is really the cause. The effect is the dysfunctional uterine bleeding. And so that's why those two terms are sometimes interchanged. It's the cause is the anovulation, but the result or the effect is the dysfunctional uterine bleeding.
That's right. And about 90% of dysfunctional uterine bleeding is on account of anovulation. And then there are some people that do ovulate and they're still having dysfunctional bleeding for other reasons. And that's the minority.
And so the next time I teach this to a medical student, I'm going to be describing bricks falling off.
I like it.
I like it. It's a great visual. All right. Strong work.
And the other consequence, besides abnormal and sometimes distressing irregular bleeding, you never know when you're going to have your period, you never know when it's going to be really heavy, is the problem with cancer risk. And so patients that have unopposed estrogen, they're not ovulating and they're just seeing a predominance of estrogen, those patients are at increased risk for all kinds of cancers, especially hyperplasia of the uterus. And so even though they might not be the age that we usually think about biopsying the endometrium, they're, you know, 35 and older, that type of thing, they might be 20.
Yeah.
But if they're having this anovulatory bleeding and unopposed estrogen, you also have to make sure that they're not developing hyperplasia and cancer in their uterus.
Yeah, absolutely. Specifically, endometrial biopsies is typically recommended.
Treatment.
Okay, and then let's talk about treatment. How are we going to wrap this up for this person who is stable? They can likely go home. Let's talk about the different management approaches.
So this is the part you've all been waiting for. What do we do with these patients that need something but are not really unstable, but they need something? What is that something?
Well, the first thing I would say is that in general, I'd like to touch base with a primary care or OBGYN in these cases because, you know, they're going to probably have some context and some input. It's often not the patient's first rodeo. Mm-hmm. And so, and you need to know where they're going. And so that's something that I think about really early on because there's a bunch of different treatment options.
Yep.
Let me just give you an example. There might be a case where a woman has dropped her hemoglobin significantly. Maybe it was 12 at one point and now it's 8 and she's getting a little bit stressed out. And, you know, it's a healthy person, but the OB actually says, you know what? I'm going to go do DNC.
Yeah.
This woman is, you know, she's had enough of this. I'm going to come in. I'm going to do a DNC. That's going to kind of reset things. That usually is enough to stop most of hormonal bleeding, you know, and get the ball rolling with the workup. And so that's a possible outcome.
Gyn will oftentimes help facilitate when that will happen for this person. Sometimes they want to see him that day. And so sometimes they'll offer to come down and do the endometrial biopsy right then and there. Sometimes they might see them in the clinic in the next couple of days after. And so I think that conversation is certainly useful.
Now, as we mentioned, Mies, the vast majority of these patients are going to have some type of hormonal therapy. And just not to have things get too fancy, just plain ordinary oral contraceptives are what almost everyone uses for this. So basically what it's going to come down to is whether or not you're going to use a mixed oral contraceptive, a typical estrogen progestin combination oral contraceptive, or in some cases, you're just going to use a progestin-only agent. And that would be in patients, Mies, that you're worried about the contraindications of the estrogen.
So let's talk about that, because when would estrogen be contraindicated? I think it's important to bring up. So patients who have any underlying cancer or concern for cancer, I certainly wouldn't want to add any estrogen to the mix. Those who want to get pregnant, and also any patients with an underlying coagulopathic disorder, you certainly don't want to give them more estrogen, making them more coagulopathic.
Giving them strokes and heart attacks. So those are the high-risk patients for that. Exactly.
Right.
Mies, let me explain how the hormones work to stop bleeding, because I think a lot of people find it confusing. Why is it that both estrogen and progestin both stop the bleeding? Well, the estrogen component stops the bleeding by continuing the process of building up the uterine lining. So they can't slough it anymore because you give them enough estrogen so that they keep building. That's how the estrogen stops bleeding.
Okay.
And so, as you know, one of the treatments for severe bleeding for the patients that are hemorrhaging and they're bleeding to death, one of the possible treatments is IV, intravenous estrogen.
Yeah.
And that's how it works, is it keeps the lining of the uterus growing and building so it can't slough. Progestin works by stabilizing the membrane for a time, and its effect then comes when they stop the Provera and they have a sloughing of all the stuff that had been built up for ages in there. So if you want to think about it this way, the estrogen stops the bleeding, but there's all kinds of mess still left in the uterus. That brick wall, if you will, is still there and there's pieces of it. It's just stabilized. And then once they get the Provera for a few days and then it stops, you get a massive sloughing. And you have to warn the patients about that, by the way. If you just use the progestin component, the way that that works is that it immediately stabilizes the endometrial lining. So it stops
growing. It adds mortar.
But it adds mortar. It adds exactly.
That's
it adds mortar. So that's what stops the bleeding. But again, they still have a huge brick wall in there. When they stop that Provera, again, they have this massive withdrawal bleeding, which you have to warn them about. And then it should clean the uterus out and they should be able to carry on with normal periods after that. In effect, it's a little bit like a chemical DNC. You're basically affecting a DNC by using hormones.
Yeah, and you're basically taking over, right? The uterus and ovaries are dysfunctional, and so you're creating an external overtake.
No, that's exactly right. I love the way that you say that. That's exactly right. Yeah. You're saying, look, the body is producing ratios of estrogen and progesterone that aren't working out for you. They're causing pain, mm-hmm. irregular bleeding, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. So now the body's going to see a fixed amount of estrogen for 2 weeks approximately, and then a fixed amount of progesterone. It's going to build, stabilize, slough. Build, yep, stabilize,
it's a takeover.
And you're going to take it over. Exactly right. Yep. Exactly right.
Yeah. The other two medications I would include in most of these patients, depending on their age and their situation, but if they're anemic, I think these patients certainly warrant supplemental iron. I think that's important. Yeah, warn them about the constipation that might come with that. You may even prescribe a colace or recommend Miralax or something to help with that side of it, but iron is certainly important. And then there's a lot of studies showing that NSAIDs, it's a little counterintuitive, but giving NSAIDs can actually help decrease bleeding up to 50%. So if they're young and they don't have kidney issues, adding NSAIDs to this regimen certainly can help them.
Yeah, that's true. You wouldn't give it to someone with a bleeding problem either to give NSAIDs. But if they don't have a bleeding problem, NSAIDs decrease the cramping because of the prostaglandin inhibition, and they decrease bleeding up to 50% in most of these patients. And so simply ibuprofen or naproxen during menses can be a huge benefit to these patients as well.
So in the unstable patient, you're going to think about IV estrogen, you're going to get OB down, maybe they're going to go for a DNC in the unstable patient. In the stable patient, in the routine patient, you're going to call OB because every single one of them has their own style. Progesterone only or estrogen or combined, they've all got their own little cocktail that they love, and I'm sure you already know that. But the idea is fix the mortar or fix mortar and bricks and then let it slough off at a later time and let it rebuild. But do not underestimate the utility of something like ibuprofen, which reduces local prostaglandin production, which reduces bleeding. And some people also use tranexamic acid, but it's some form of hormonal manipulation, some non-steroidal, and that's all you need to know for the vast majority of people. Exactly which one to use is subtle and often not based on evidence, but based on sort of what people like regionally. Then the question is, who can go home? Obviously in the stable patients, it's most.
Admission.
So Stuart, of these patients, who of these would you be concerned enough to admit them overnight?
Well, I think that's really a judgment call, Mies. Almost all these patients that are young and healthy can go home. I think when you start to talk about a hemoglobin that's dropped really significantly, you know, when it goes down to 7, 8, that starts to get pretty concerning, especially if you think it's happened over a relatively short amount of time. Mm-hmm. When you get into comorbidities, the patient has a blood disorder, they have kidney, liver problems, those things are going to really decrease my threshold for admission. And so that's sort of the basic gist of it. The vast majority, again, you know, they don't want to be in the hospital and they're well aware when they start bleeding again. And if it gets bad, they can come back.